Welcome, guys, to episode 227 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name's James Gearing, and I'm so excited to bring to you this week Dr. Michael Greger. Now, Dr. Greger is the founder of NutritionFacts.org. He is the author of the best-selling book, How Not to Die. And most importantly to me, he has put a huge amount of free content out there to educate people on the healing and disease-reversing properties of a plant-based diet. So a really powerful conversation. You'll notice it's a very short conversation compared to some of my interviews, but I use a kind of rapid fire questioning to try and draw out as much as I could, especially regarding heart disease and cancer and some of these supposedly incurable diseases, to really illustrate how powerful a plant-based diet can be. So as I always say before we start the interview, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, whichever one you use to listen to this podcast. And just take a moment to subscribe, leave feedback, and a rating. Every rating that we get on iTunes or in those apps make us more visible to everyone else who's looking for this project. And then most importantly, take your social media, use it for good, and share these incredible podcasts. Every single one of these men and women that's taken their time to tell their story has so much information and content that I know will benefit so many people that need to hear it. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. Michael Greger. Enjoy. Dr. Greger, I want to start by saying welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for taking the time.
Happy to help out. Let's do it.
All right. So very first question, where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
I am coming to you live from my treadmill in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Excellent. I love that. All right. So because we've got 30 minutes, I really want to kind of skip some of the icebreakers and really get to the meat and potatoes. But I think a great, interesting, you know, story that really kind of starts everything is your grandmother's illness. So if you wouldn't mind just talking about that and how that influenced not only her health, but then your introduction into medicine.
Sure. Straight to the kale and potatoes. I was just a kid when the doctor sent my grandma home in a wheelchair to die. She was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease, already had so many bypass surgeries, basically it run out of plumbing at some point. So confined to a wheelchair, crushing chest pain, her life was over at age 65. Let's hear about this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers. And what happened next is actually detailed in Pritikin's biography. It talks about Frances Greger, my grandmother. They wheeled her in and she walked out. She was given a medical death sentence at age 65, but thanks to a healthy diet, went on to live another 31 years till age 96 to continue to enjoy her six grandkids, including me. That's why I went into medicine. That's why I started NutritionFacts.org, why I wrote the book How Not to Die, why 100% of the proceeds I get from my books are all donated to charity. I just want to do for everyone's family what Pritikin did for my family.
Brilliant. And that's the one point I really want to start with as well. So you're not out there, you know, making a fortune on all these different DVD sets and books, kind of like this podcast too, because I do this for free for everyone listening as well. There's no real attachment to any money whatsoever. I'm just a fireman trying to be part of the solution. But I think that's a very powerful point that you have all these books and you're just trying to educate people. So there is no ulterior motive that usually to me shows someone who's driving from a very pure place.
Well, that's why all doctors should have gone to medicine. I mean, I think generally, people go into the healthcare field, you know, look, they wanted to just make money. They would go to the stock market or something, but people go in the healthcare field because they want to take care of people. Now, often that is kind of beaten out of them through medical education or training. And they may end up kind of demanding reparations for getting their first BMW or something. But I mean, I think, you know, when you talk to medical students, for example, there's a real kind of youthful idealism that draws people in. And as long as they can hold on to that, I think they can do wonderful things in the world.
Absolutely. Now, that's something that I've seen. Again, I'm a layman. I do have a degree in exercise physiology. That's as far as my training goes, aside from being a paramedic. But all those kind of angles and views have showed me now at age of 45 that, yes, the way that we do many of our chronic disease management techniques and the way that we're eating are categorically, hands down, killing our people. So what was it that on your road through medicine really made you realize, apart from your grandmother's story, of course, the sleep and the nutrition side was going to be so much more powerful than a lot of what the textbooks were teaching you?
Well, you know, so yeah, the reversal of end-stage heart disease with this kind of plant-based diet and lifestyle program is really what inspired me to go to med school. But once I got there, I was shocked to find out this whole body of evidence on reversing chronic disease with lifestyle changes, you know, opening up arteries without drugs, without surgery, was, you know, largely ignored by mainstream medicine. So I figured, wait a second, if the cure to our number one killer could get lost down some rabbit hole and ignored, you know, what else might there be buried in the medical literature that could help my patients? Well, I made it my life's mission to find out. So that's what led me to start the website. So there's basically this mountain of evidence. It already exists. There's just no corporate budget driving its promotion. You know, some new study on broccoli comes out, there's no press release. There's no, like, you know, ads on TV, or there's no, I mean, there's just, it just, you know, it just exists. And it's just a matter of me, you know, digging through the stacks and, you know, bringing out what we already know to the public.
Right. So I really want to delve into your mind now and really explore the world of food. As an overall diet here in America, you know, in England, where I'm from originally, and all the associated countries that eat the way we do, what are the main culprits causing the ill health in the first place?
Well, so if you look at the Global Burden of Disease study, for example, the largest study of disease risk factors in history, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the number one dietary cause of death. So the number one cause of death is diet. Smoking has been bumped to number two. And what about our diet is the worst? Well, the five worst things they've identified is, number one is too much sodium. So I encourage people to stick to the American Heart Association's recommendation of 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day, which is basically eliminates processed food from one's diet. So that's the number one dietary risk factor for death on planet Earth. And the other four is inadequate whole grain consumption, inadequate vegetable consumption, inadequate fruit consumption, and inadequate nut and seed consumption. So it's interesting that four out of the five is not something we eat too much of, but actually something we're not eating enough of, and that are these whole plant foods.
Yeah, that's an observation that I've made, is that, you know, we are overfed and malnourished, which is a crazy contradiction of terms.
Right. I mean, so yeah, we have a billion people that are you know, overweight. We have, you know, a billion people who are not getting enough, you know, who are food insecure. I mean, it's really kind of a strange world we live in, but it's a matter of, you know, I mean, but the science is clear what we need to eat. We just need to be able to, you know, make it happen in our day-to-day lives.
Right. Now, with the world of meat, I know obviously now finally the processed meats are getting some attention, all the chemicals that they're throwing in those. When it comes to the people that advise, you know, occasional meat and it's, you know, grass-fed and the most natural way that we can raise our food, what is your perspective on a little meat in a plant-based diet?
Oh, well, look, it doesn't matter what you eat on your birthdays, your holiday, special occasions. It's the day-to-day stuff that really adds up. And on a day-to-day basis, we really should indeed, you know, try to eat healthy. So look, there are some meats that are less harmful than others. Absolutely. There's a study, a famous study out of Australia, for example, found that eating wild game, which is kangaroo in their case, had led to a significantly less bump in inflammation compared to conventionally store-bought meat. Certainly one could argue, you know, why eat pro-inflammatory foods at all? Why not eat foods that actually have an anti-inflammatory effect, like most whole plant foods? Better, absolutely, step in the right direction, sure. By eating higher quality meats, presumably they're more expensive, so you're eating less of them. So I think that's a real advantage. Ideally, the more kind of whole plant foods we can stuff into our diet, the better.
Right, and then the argument a lot of times is the you know, evolution. We have canines, you know, we're omnivores. What is your view on the diet of, you know, Homo sapiens and you know, the influence of meat within that journey?
Oh, so yeah, so I think it's useful to look back and say, what is our biology designed to eat? But it's interesting. So the paleo diet advocates go back about 2 million years when we started into the Paleolithic period and we start using tools. We kind of split off from the last great ape ancestor back in the Miocene era about 20 million years ago. So for the first 90% of our evolution, before we started, we started to sharpening spears and certainly boiling sugarcane or refining grains. 90% of our evolution, where all our digestive system, all our enzymes put together, was in the context of eating what the rest of our great ape cousins eat, which is almost exclusively plant-based diet. In fact, we even lost the ability to make vitamin C. Most animals actually just make vitamin C from scratch. We have the genes to do it, but they were junked basically by our body because, look, all we're doing is eating leaves and fruits all day, getting all the vitamin C we need. So we, guinea pigs, fruit bats, and a couple other species just lost the ability to make vitamin C. Why even care? Of course, now you can get scurvy, but that was not a problem in kind of our natural setting. So I do encourage people to go back to our roots, no pun intended, by eating the way our biology was designed. But instead of just looking at the last 10%, really looking at the foundational 90% of our evolution, which is really evolved around whole plant foods.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, if we were, hunter-gatherers, obviously the gathering is a lot easier than the hunting. And without weapons, if you go far enough back, we would be pretty crap at catching fish and chasing most animals.
Right, and it's all about, you obviously have to get more calories in than you burn. And so that's why we developed this taste for, fat, starch, sugar, because that's where the calories are. And of course, we evolved in the context of there weren't salt shakers around. So we have this lust for, calorie dense foods, for sweet, starchy, fatty, salty foods. And so what the processed food industry has taken those natural biological, has hijacked those natural biological drives, turned them against us to make these hyper salty, hyper fatty, hyper sweet foods that basically, can force us to just not eat one, and has led, helped lead to this, epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes and something really fighting with. A big part of that is the industry, which has, created this kind of bliss point where people just have these almost like addictive like relationships with some of these processed foods. And ideally, we should eat instead foods as grown, and stay away particularly from these ultra processed foods, which are very profitable, but unfortunately may lead to good shelf life, but not good human life.
Absolutely. All right. Well, one area that I really want to explore with you is cancer. As well as the obesity, we're seeing, a huge increase in what it seems to be, at least in cancer, not only in pediatric cancer, but obviously all the ones in the adults, many of which through my layman eyes appear to be also influenced through diet and the environment. So what is your perspective on the cancer causing agents, and are they, predominantly from our diet?
Actually, the obesity epidemic may indeed be part of the rising cancer rate. So right now, the lifelong cancer risk for men and women is about 40%, about a 40% chance. And this is, we're talking about invasive cancer. It's about a 40% chance any of us will get an invasive cancer sometime in their life. So we're not talking about something like a little, skin cancer that you just kind of cut off. And part of that is because of the obesity epidemic. If you survey people, about 3/4 of people evidently unaware of the link between obesity and cancer. But if you look at, there was a comprehensive review of more than 1,000 studies, excess body fat increases risk of most cancers, including esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colorectal cancer, liver, gallbladder, pancreatic, breast, uterine, ovarian, kidney, brain, thyroid, bone marrow cancer. And so we think it's actually because of the chronic inflammation associated with obesity or the high insulin levels, thanks to insulin resistance. In women, it could be the excess estrogen. At menopause, women's, ovaries shut down. And so fat actually takes over as the principal site of estrogen production. That's why obese women have about twice the estrogen levels, circulating in their bloodstream, which may increase your risk of developing and dying from breast cancer. And we know this is not just kind of, you know, we know this is cause and effect, because if you, for example, follow people that have gotten gastric bypass surgery, for example, you can see significant drops in cancer risk, losing a significant amount of body weight. So, I mean, that certainly is one way diet plays into it. Alcohol certainly increases, even light drinking, for example, 1-2 glasses a day of wine may increase breast cancer risk. Processed meat consumption is considered group 1 carcinogen. So bacon, ham, hot dogs, lunch meat, sausage. We now know that we are as sure that they cause cancer as asbestos causes cancer and cigarette smoke and plutonium. They're group 1 carcinogens according to the IARC, the official kind of World Health Organization body that determines what is and is not cancer causing. And so, look, you know, we try to not to, you know, smoke around our kids. Why would we send them to school with a bologna sandwich? And we know these foods cause cancer. This is something I brought up to the Dietary Guidelines Committee meeting a few weeks ago. It's just outrageous that people don't know about this.
Absolutely. Now, on the flip side, so people that have already discovered that they have cancer, you have places where you can treat cancer purely with nutrition in Portugal, in Mexico, and sadly, they are always forced outside of the UK and the US. Have you in your career seen a great success with people not doing chemo and radiation, but actually trying everything they can to put their body back in homeostasis instead?
Well, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about lifestyle interventions like diet, is that they can be done in conjunction with whatever else. Your doctor wants you to do radiation, chemotherapy, both, surgery, anything. Whatever you and your doctor choose. On top of that, you can also eat healthfully to maximize your body's ability to fight off the cancer, to withstand the sometimes devastating effects of some of the treatments that we have for it. And so it's not either or. Depending on the cancer, one may choose a multi-pronged strategy to attack it. But regardless of what you choose, you can always eat healthier. Now, what Ornish showed, Dr. Dean Ornish, after he conquered our number one killer, heart disease, with his lifestyle heart trial in 1990, he moved on to killer number two, cancer. And he took the same diet, this plant-based diet, and took a group of men with early-stage prostate cancer, randomized them, half of them to that plant-based diet, and for the first time was able to show in a randomized controlled trial a reversal of the progression of cancer. The PSA levels actually dropped compared to the control group that continued to increase, suggesting a shrinkage of their tumors. You can take blood from people eating plant-based diet and show that they're 70% better at, killing off cancer cells in a petri dish. We think that's a down regulation of IGF-1, which is a growth hormone, which associated with increased cancer growth. There's all sorts of ways in which eating healthier can boost your body's ability to fight off cancer, increasing the natural killer cell activity, one of our kind of front lines for so-called immunosurveillance or cancer surveillance of our immune system. There are case reports of water-only fasting. There was a great case in British Medical Journal case reports at True North Clinic in California, where a woman with stage 3 lymphoma had this remarkable reversal. They just published their 3-year update, and she remains cancer-free. And there's exciting things like that in the literature. And of course, after she fasted for 2 weeks, it put her on a strictly on no added salt, plant-based diet, and she's doing remarkably well. These should all be options that are available to people. But if there's good data to suggest that chemo is going to help with your cancer, radiation, I would consider patients seriously consider it.
Right. Yeah. See, that's the thing. Cause from my perspective, like you said, 40% of the population is going to get some sort of cancer. And that's directly related to, the diet and the other factors that you talked about. And obviously, if you talk about our species, that has to be an environmental input, because we're pretty well designed to survive. So that's a horrible survival rate when you look at it. So why not then reverse, as you're saying, all the factors that have caused it and see if that stops it. You know, the adding more insult to the immune system and destroying the body even further, to my layman brain, doesn't seem like the most intelligent way of trying to attack something that you've done to yourself already.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know that these are environmental causes, because you can look around the world and see cancer rates of our common cancers, like breast, colon, prostate, vary hundredfold around the world. And we know that's not just some kind of genetic predisposition, because migration studies show that basically your cancer risk is wherever you're living and eating. And so, you know, Japanese men who have extremely low prostate cancer rates, when they move to California, for example, start eating and living like California, their prostate cancer rates shoot through the roof, whereas the reverse happens in the other direction. Now, of course, we have randomized controlled trials where you put people on their diet and see some of these improvements. And so, you know, that, I mean, when we look around the world and say, wait a second, why is there a hundredfold differences in lung cancer rates? We say, wow, there must be something that really plays a role. So we have control over lung cancer. If the rates were the same everywhere, we'd assume that it's just some kind of, there's nothing we can do about it. But, oh, and then we discovered, oh, tobacco smoking is probably the primary risk factor for lung cancer and a number of other cancers. And similarly, diet plays a major role in many of our most common cancers.
Right. Yeah. And I think the China study and Forks Over Knives and some of those, you know, those documentaries and books that were delivered to, again, us, the layman, it's kind of hard to refute a lot of that data when you've got areas that are, you know, as you said, that have a very, very, high number of people in their hundreds. And then all of a sudden the lifestyle changes, food chains come in or cigarette smoke comes in, and all of a sudden those numbers plummet then.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you can see within a generation. And so, like, you look at the Okinawa Japanese, one of the longest living populations of the earth, until they started opening up KFCs. And now they're actually one of the unhealthiest populations within Japan. That's because they so westernized their diet. It's really kind of sad what we've done. We've kind of exported this diet and lifestyle around the world. And now, you know, soon, the leading causes of death are going to be these chronic diseases, which is good in that we can do something about them, right? And we can treat the cause and reverse them in many cases. But it's bad when we're sticking with this kind of traditional medical model of just putting people on drugs for the rest of their lives to treat their blood pressure or cholesterol, when we really should be treating the cause and eliminating the problem in the first place.
Absolutely. Now, an area that I am convinced causes a huge amount of ill health, mentally and physically, in first responders is the shift work and the sleep deprivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is your view on sleep and sleep deprivation and the causes of that in the body?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the biggest problem with shift work is this, you know, you're interfering with your circadian rhythms. There's this whole burgeoning field of chronobiology, which suggests that even if you get enough sleep, even without the sleep deprivation, when people do shift work, I mean, they don't call it, you know, graveyard shift for nothing. When you do shift work, you are at significantly increased risk of all range of metabolic disease and a significantly shortened lifespan. What you can do, and part of that is actually eating. At night, we really shouldn't be eating when it's dark outside. It actually affects our bodies in ways that are have all sorts of negative effects. And so we may not have control over, you know, bright lights during nighttime, et cetera, you know, if you're working a night shift. But what we can do is try to reduce our caloric intake at night, and that can help mediate some of the damage that we get from that circadian disruption.
Right. Now, speaking of the brain itself, what about the effects of, you know, the food choices on mental health?
Oh, yeah. Well, so there's only been one diet ever been proven to actually improve mood, for example, in a randomized controlled trial. And that was this plant-based diet where they took people eating kind of traditional American diet, removed meat, including fish, as well as eggs from their diet. So, like, significant improvement in mood within just 2 weeks. Now, I think it's this arachidonic acid, this long chain of inflammatory omega-6 fatty acid found predominantly in chicken and eggs, but throughout animal products. They think it may be causing what's called neuroinflammation or brain inflammation, but we can reduce that inflammation with our brains in as short as 2 weeks by removing chicken, other meat, eggs from our diet. I mean, that's we're kind of speculating as why that's the case, but we did see that significant improvement in mood in other diets, been shown to do that. Now, what that hasn't been done is a similar kind of study on people with a major mental illness. So these weren't people with, you know, major depression, for example, that got better. These are people that felt okay and then felt better after 2 weeks. And so that's what these studies really need to be in the next phase. I think the only dietary studies have on major mental illness are on anxiety disorder, showing that, for example, for people with generalized anxiety disorder, giving people squash seeds because of the high tryptophan, low protein combination may actually improve anxiety disorder symptoms. I have a video on that. Really? Butternut squash seeds, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. And like you said earlier, with the sugar and the salt, you know, we really have created this environment now where we have an emotional attachment to our food. So I think there's that interrelation there versus, you know, if it was just the clean plant-based, would that still be the same? Would you you know, have a bad day and then say, okay, I need to go eat a zucchini now? Probably not.
Right. People aren't getting up in the middle of the night binging on broccoli. That is very true. Right. I mean, there's a reason, right, that people, you know, we have these drives towards, particularly these fatty sugary combinations, like, you know, chocolate frosting, that kind of thing, where that seems to be particularly potent effect, because out in nature there aren't natural foods with both, with the exception of human breast milk, which may have been why we evolved to have this real predilection for that combination. And of course, the processed food industry is more than happy to provide us with ice cream and things like that, which really tap into those kind of brain reward systems, but unfortunately at the expense of our health.
Right. So then the last question before we go to where people can find the websites. So someone listening now, let's say they've got type 2 diabetes, hypertension, you know, all these diseases that we see, the chronic diseases, they're eating the average American diet. I know that's a broad term, but what kind of advice would you give them to how to begin to change their diet and what to kind of remove initially?
I would tell them that the tremendous good news, and that is we have, you know, power over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors, and high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes are not just arrestable, but reversible with a healthy enough diet. And so I would encourage them to, you know, go all in. There's a wonderful program called the 21-Day Kickstart Program. It's free. It's put on by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. It starts at the first of each month. It's a bunch of different languages. Hundreds of thousands of people have done it. You do it as part of a social media group, and you get, like, daily recipes and inspiration. The hope is, you know, after 3 weeks, you'll just feel so good that you'll have that internal motivation to keep it up. And if you do have a chronic illness like this, I encourage you to go get your labs taken before and after, just so you see the dramatic difference in health indicators as well. These are something like diabetes, number one cause of lower limb amputations, blindness, dialysis, kidney failure. But none of that is inevitable. That's only if you continue to eat the standard American diet, where you'll die of the standard American diseases. But there's no reason to do that. And you really do have control at the end of your fork. So that is the good news. And if anyone's interested in learning more, they can check out my website, nutritionfacts.org.
Brilliant. All right. And then just want to talk about the book as well. So the book is called How Not to Die, which I think is one of the best titles I've ever read. And then you have a cookbook attached to that as well.
Sure. And then December of this year, How Not to Diet on Weight Loss is coming out December 10th.
Perfect. All right. Well, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, again, I want to underline to everyone listening that, as you said, the proceeds go to help the cause. You've got the websites, it's all free information. And I think that's a big, big thing. When people are doing this out of the love of, you know, wanting to make change in the world, I think that's very powerful. So I urge everyone to go to nutritionfacts.org, learn more. I never felt better than when I was on the plant-based diet. I've got to be honest, I had Rip Esselstyn on the show. He talks about the same thing. So, you know, even if it's just to reverse some issues for now, use that as a, you know, as a goal. And then obviously, if you carry it on, then even better. But yeah, I mean, there's no question in my mind that I felt better. And there's no question in all the research I've done that so many of these diseases are reversible, and, you know, it puts the power back in the individual instead of the industries.
Fantastic. Then we'll need. Then our paramedics can leave more relaxed lifestyles and get some sleep when they're not getting calls all the time for people clutching at their chests.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and it's been a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work yourself.